Mr. Chief Justice, counsel for the President, members of the United States Senate, my name is Congressman James E. Rogan, and I represent the 27th District of California. May I say at the outset that some of the facts and evidence you will hear in my presentation may sound familiar in light of the last presentation. Although at times the facts may appear to be a crossover, the relevance will be presented in a different light. Mr. Manager Hutchinson's presentation offered the evidence as it relates to the obstruction of justice charge against the President in Article 2. I will be inviting this body to view the evidence within the framework of Article 1, perjury before the grand jury. On behalf of the House of Representatives and in the name of the people of the United States, I will be presenting to the Senate evidence against the President to demonstrate he committed perjury before a federal grand jury as set forth in Article 1 of the Articles of Impeachment. Article 1 of the impeachment resolution against President Clinton alleges that he committed committed perjury before the grand jury. On August 17, 1998, President Clinton swore to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. The evidence shows that contrary to that oath, the President willfully provided perjurious, false, and misleading statements to the grand jury in four general areas. First, he perjured himself when he gave a false account to the grand jury about the nature and details of his relationship with a 21-year-old intern, Monica Lewinsky, who was a subordinate federal government employee. Second, he perjured himself before the grand jury when he repeated previous perjured answers he gave under oath in a sexual harassment suit, which was a federal civil rights action brought against him by Paula Jones. Third, he perjured himself before the grand jury when he repeated previous perjured answers to justify his attorney's false representations to a federal judge in the Paula Jones sexual harassment lawsuit against him. Finally, he perjured himself before the grand jury when he testified falsely about his attempts to get other potential grand jury witnesses to tell false stories to the grand jury and to prevent the discovery of evidence in Paula Jones's sexual harassment lawsuit against him. In a judicial proceeding, a witness has a very solemn obligation to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Perjury is a serious crime because our judicial system can only succeed if citizens are required to tell the truth in court proceedings. If witnesses may lie with impunity for personal or political reasons, justice is no longer the product of the court system, and we descend into chaos. That is why the United States Supreme Court has placed a premium on truthful testimony and shows no tolerance for perjury. More than 20 years ago, the court addressed this very concept of perjury and its dangerous effect on our system of law. Listen to the words of the United States Supreme Court. In this constitutional process of securing a witness's testimony, perjury simply has no place whatever. Perjured testimony is an obvious and flagrant affront to the basic concepts of judicial proceedings. Congress has made the giving of false answers a criminal act, punishable by severe penalties. In no other way can criminal conduct be flushed into the open where the law can deal with it. That is the framework under which the House of Representatives acted in impeaching the President of the United States, and now respectfully urges this body to call the President to constitutional accountability. The key to understanding the facts of this case is to understand why the President was asked under oath questions about his private life in the first place. Despite the popular spin, it wasn't because members of Congress or lawyers from the Office of Independent Counsel or a gaggle of reporters suddenly decided to invade the President's privacy. No, this all came about because of a claim against the President from when he was the governor of Arkansas. During the discovery phase of the Paula Jones sexual harassment case against the President, Federal Judge Susan Weber Wright ordered him to answer questions under oath relating to any sexual relationship he may have had while governor and president with subordinate female government employees. These orders are common in similar cases. And the questions posed to President Clinton are questions routinely posed to defendants in civil rights sexual harassment cases every single day in this country in courthouses throughout the land. During the president's deposition in the Paula Jones case, he was asked questions about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. The judge allowed these questions because they possibly could lead Mrs. Jones to discover if there was any pattern of conduct to help prove her case. The president repeatedly denied that he had a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. A few days later, the story about his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky broke in the press. A criminal investigation began to determine whether the president perjured himself in the Paula Jones sexual harassment case and obstructed justice by trying to defeat her claim against him by corrupt means. On the afternoon of August 17, 1998, President Clinton raised his right hand and took an oath before the grand jury in their criminal investigation.
Mr. President, with the agent I am asking, we solemnly swear to the testimony of the affidavit and the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God.
I do.
Note the incredible solemn obligation of the oath the president took. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you are about to give in this matter will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? When the president made that solemn pledge, he was not obliging himself to tell the grand jury the partial truth. He was not obliging himself to tell the "I didn't want to be particularly helpful" truth. He was not obliging himself to tell the "this is embarrassing, so I think I'll fudge on it a little bit" truth. He was required to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and he made that pledge in the name of God. The attorneys for the Office of Independent Counsel showed great deference to the president when they questioned him that day. The president's attorneys were allowed to be there with him during the entire proceeding so that he could confer with them at his leisure if he was unsure of how to respond to a question. As a matter of fact, the attorney who questioned the president encouraged him to confer with his lawyer if there arose in the president's mind any reason to hesitate before answering a question. The following exchange occurred at the beginning of the president's testimony. The president was told, normally, grand jury witnesses, while not allowed to have attorneys in the grand jury room with them, can stop and consult with their attorneys. Under our arrangement today, your attorneys are here and present for consultation, and you can break to consult with them as necessary. Do you understand that? The president responded, "I do understand that." As a practical matter, the president had three options as he appeared before the grand jury to testify. First, the president could tell the truth about his true relationship with Monica Lewinsky. However, the evidence will clearly show that the president rejected the option of telling the truth. Second, the president could invoke his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. The independent counsel's attorney explicitly reminded the president about his right to refuse to answer any question that might tend to incriminate him. The president was asked, "You have a privilege against self-incrimination. If a truthful answer to any question would tend to incriminate you, you can invoke the privilege, and that invocation will not be used against you. Do you understand?" The president's response was, "I do." The president knew he had the right to refuse to answer any incriminating questions, and that no legal harm would come to him for doing so. But he rejected that option, just as he rejected the option of telling the truth. Instead, he selected a third path. He continued to lie about corrupt efforts to destroy Paula Jones's sexual harassment case against him. If a trial is permitted before this body, where live witnesses can be called, and where their credibility can be scrutinized, the evidence will show this distinguished body that the course the president charted was a course of perjury. Despite the president's unique level of judicial sophistication and expertise, the attorneys at the grand jury were careful to make sure the president understood the responsibilities to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. They did this at the outset of his testimony, before any questions were asked that might tempt the president to lie under oath. And they specifically warned him that if he were to lie or intentionally mislead the grand jury, he could face perjury and obstruction of justice charges, both of which are felonies under federal law. This exchange occurred before the president's testimony. Mr. President, you understand that your testimony here today is under oath. Answer, I do. And you understand that because you have sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, that if you were to lie or intentionally mislead the grand jury, you could be prosecuted for perjury and/or obstruction of justice. Answer, I believe that's correct. Question, is there anything that I've stated to you regarding your rights and responsibilities that you would like me to clarify or that you don't understand? Answer, no, sir. Despite this ominous warning, the prosecutors continue emphasizing the need for the president to resist lying to the grand jury. Still intent on making sure the president understood his obligations, the attorneys further advised him, Mr. President, I would like to read for you a portion of Federal Rule of Evidence 603, which discusses the important function the oath has in our judicial system. It says that the purpose of the oath is calculated to awaken the witness's conscience and impress the witness's mind with the duty to tell the truth. Could you please tell the grand jury what that oath means to you for today's testimony? The president responded, I have sworn an oath to tell the grand jury the truth, and that's what I intend to do. When the president said in that very last answer I just read that he swore an oath to tell the grand jury the truth, the prosecutor immediately followed up with another question. Here is what he was told. Question to the president. You understand that the oath requires you to give the whole truth, that is, a complete answer to each question, sir. Answer by the president. I will answer each question as accurately and fully as I can. Now, one would think these repetitive explanations to the President of the United States would be enough to warn even the most legally unsophisticated witness about the need to treat a grand jury criminal investigation seriously and the need to tell the whole truth at any cost. No reasonable person could believe at this point that the President did not understand his obligations. Yet, just to be sure, the attorneys impressed on the president his solemn duty to tell the truth. Question to the president. Now, you took the same oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth on January 17, 1998, in a deposition in the Paula Jones litigation. Is that correct, sir? Answer by the president. I did take an oath then. Question, did the oath you took on that occasion mean the same to you then as it does today? Answer, I believed then that I had to answer the questions truthfully. That is correct. Question, and it meant the same to you then as it does today? Answer: well, no one read me a definition then, and we didn't go through this exercise then. I swore an oath to tell the truth, and I believed I was bound to be truthful, and I tried to be. Having just received his refresher course on either taking the fifth and remaining silent, or telling the whole truth and nothing but the truth, the president acknowledged he was required to tell the truth when he gave answers to questions 8 months earlier in the Paula Jones sexual harassment civil rights lawsuit. Question to the president. At the Paula Jones deposition, you were represented by Mr. Robert Bennett, your counsel. Is that correct? Answer: that is correct. Question: he was authorized by you to be your representative there, your attorney. Is that correct? Answer: that is correct. Question: your counsel, Mr. Bennett, indicated, and I'm quoting, "The president intends to give full and complete answers as Ms. Jones is entitled to have." My question to you is, do you agree with your counsel that a plaintiff in a sexual harassment case is, to use his words, entitled to have the truth? Answer by the president: I believe that I was bound to give truthful answers. Yes, sir. Question: but the question is, sir, do you agree with your counsel that a plaintiff in a sexual harassment case is entitled to have the truth? Answer by the president: I believe when a witness is under oath in a civil case or otherwise under oath, the witness should do everything possible to answer the questions truthfully. Thus, the groundwork was laid for the president to testify under oath before the grand jury. He knew how the rules worked respecting testimony before the grand jury. If a question was vague or ambiguous, the president could ask for a clarification. If he was unsure how to answer, or indeed whether to answer a question, he could stop the questioning, take a break, and consult privately with his attorneys who were present with him. If giving an answer would tend to incriminate him, he could refuse to answer the question by claiming his Fifth Amendment rights. But if, after all of this, he decided to give an answer, the answer he gave was required to be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And it was no different than the obligation when he testified in the Paula Jones deposition. Same oath, same obligation. Let's look at how the president chose to meet his obligation. As noted in my opening remarks, the president's grand jury perjury is the basis for Article I of the impeachment resolution. The evidence shows, and live witnesses clearly will demonstrate, that the president repeatedly committed perjury before the grand jury when he testified as a defendant in the sexual harassment civil rights lawsuit against him. He intentionally failed in his lawful obligation to tell the truth in four general areas. First, the president committed perjury before the grand jury when he testified about the nature of his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, a 21-year-old White House intern who, by definition, was a subordinate government employee. On December 5, 1997, Monica Lewinsky's name appeared on the Paula Jones witness list. Later, the president was ordered by federal judge Susan Weber Wright to answer questions about Monica Lewinsky because the president was a defendant in a sexual harassment case. At his deposition in the Paula Jones case, the president was shown a definition approved by Judge Wright of what constitutes sexual relations. Take the chart down. I'm going to read the definition that was presented to the president. And let me say at the outset that I'm going to slightly sanitize it. You have in your materials, members of this body, a copy of the actual definition that was given to him, so you will be able to understand precisely what was put before the president. Definition of sexual relations. For the purposes of this deposition, A person engages in sexual relations when the person knowingly engages in or causes contact with the certain enumerated body parts of any person with an intent to arouse or gratify the sexual desire of any person. Members of the Senate, just for clarification, I did not feel the need to actually relate to this body what those enumerated body parts are. After reviewing the definition, the president then denied that he ever had a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. As we have already seen, from the day in January when the president testified in the Jones deposition until the day he appeared in August for his grand jury testimony, he vehemently denied ever having a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. Listen to the president addressing the American people on the subject of his credibility. The date is January 26, 1998, 5 days after the Lewinsky story broke in the press.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Beginning in January 1998, the president went on an 8-month campaign, both under oath and in the press, denying any sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky in any way, shape, or form. But 8 months after his deposition testimony and these passionate denials, the tide had turned against his story. By August, Monica Lewinsky was now cooperating with the Office of the Independent Counsel. If she was telling the truth in her sworn testimony, then the president's January denial in the Paula Jones case would have been a clear case of him committing perjury and obstructing justice. Why? Because she was describing, in very graphic detail, conduct occurring between her and the president that clearly fit the definition of sexual relations as used in the Paula Jones deposition. Conduct that he repeatedly denied under oath. So by the time the president sat down for his grand jury testimony to answer these questions under oath, he had put himself in a huge box. He could not continue the outright lie because Ms. Lewinsky had turned over her blue dress for DNA testing. And at the time of his grand jury testimony, he didn't know what the results were of that FBI test. Under such circumstances, continuing the lie was too risky of a strategy, even for the most accomplished of gamblers. But if he told the truth, his earlier perjury and obstruction of justice would have ended his presidency. He was sure he would have been driven from office. Remember that the president had actually authorized that a poll be taken for him by Dick Morris. And the poll wasn't just taken on whether the American people would forgive him for adultery. The president asked Dick Morris to poll in two other areas. He asked Dick Morris to poll whether the American people would forgive him for perjury and obstruction of justice. When he got the poll results back, he learned that the American people would forgive the perjury, but they would not forgive, strike that, they would forgive him for the adultery, but they would not forgive him for perjury or for obstruction of justice. Once he got the bad news from Dick Morris that his political career was over if he perjured himself, he told Dick Morris, "We'll just have to win." So at his grand jury testimony, once the first question was asked about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, the president produced a prepared statement and read from it. This prepared statement he read to the grand jury on August 17, 1998, was the linchpin in his plan to win.
Mr. President, were you physically intimate with Monica Lewinsky?
Mr. Bittman, I think maybe I can save you and the grand jury a lot of time. if I read a statement which I think will make it clear what the nature of my relationship with Ms. Lewinsky was, how it related to the testimony I gave, what I was trying to do in that testimony. And I think it will perhaps make it possible for you to ask even more relevant questions from your point of view. And with your permission, I'd like to read that statement.
Absolutely, please.
When I was alone with Ms. Lewinsky, on certain occasions in early 1996 and once in early 1997, I engaged in conduct that was wrong. These encounters did not consist of sexual intercourse. They did not constitute sexual relations as I understood that term to be defined at my January 17, 1998. Deposition. But they did involve inappropriate intimate contact. These inappropriate encounters ended at my insistence in early 1997. I also had occasional telephone conversations with Ms. Lewinsky that included inappropriate sexual banter. I regret that what began as a friendship came to include this conduct, and I take full responsibility for my actions. While I will provide the grand jury whatever other information I can, because of privacy considerations affecting my family, myself, and others, and in an effort to preserve the dignity of the office I hold, this is all I will say about the specifics of these particular matters. I will try to answer to the best of my ability other questions, including questions about my relationship with Ms. Lewinsky, questions about my understanding of the term sexual relations as I understood it to be defined at my January 17, 1998 deposition, and questions concerning alleged subornation of perjury, obstruction of justice, and intimidation of witnesses. That, Mr. Bittman, is my statement.
Beyond that statement, the President generally refused to answer specific questions about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. The President used that prepared statement as a substitute answer for specific questions about his conduct with Ms. Lewinsky 19 separate times during his testimony before the grand jury. The purpose of the prepared statement was to avoid answering the types of specific harassment lawsuit questions for which the United States Supreme Court and Judge Susan Weber Wright had earlier cleared the way. The evidence shows the President used this prepared statement in order to justify the perjurious answers he gave at his deposition, which were intended to affect the outcome of the Paula Jones case. The fact that this statement was prepared in advance shows his intent to mislead the grand jury in this very area. Ironically, this prepared statement was supposed to inoculate the President from perjury. Instead, it opened him up to 19 more examples of giving perjurious, false, and misleading answers under oath. For example, in that prepared statement, the President said his sexual contact with Ms. Lewinsky began in 1996 and not in 1995, as Ms. Lewinsky had testified. This was not a mere slip of memory over a meaningless time frame. There is a discrepancy in the dates for a reason. You see, under the President's version, in 1996, Monica Lewinsky was a paid White House employee. Under the facts as testified to by Ms. Lewinsky, when the relationship really began in 1995, she was not a paid employee at the White House. She was a young 21-year-old White House intern. The concept of a president having a sexual relationship in the White House with a young intern less than half his age, was a public relations disaster for the president, as everyone vividly remembers. It is clear that the president somehow viewed the concept as less combustible if he could take the young intern phrase out of the public lexicon. Yet in his deposition testimony, the president admitted he met her and saw her when she was an intern working in the White House in November 1995 during the government shutdown. Monica Lewinsky confirmed this. In fact, she testified that the first time she ever spoke to the president was on November 15, 1998, during the government shutdown. And she also said that the very first time that she ever spoke to the president was the same day he invited her back to the Oval Office and began a sexual relationship with her. It is obvious that the reference in the president's prepared statement to the grand jury that this relationship began in 1996 was intentionally false. The president's statement was intentionally misleading when he described being alone with Ms. Lewinsky only on certain occasions. Actually, they were alone in the White House at least 20 times and had at least 11 sexual encounters at the White House. The president attempted to use language that subtly minimized the number of times they were alone. The president's statement was intentionally misleading when he described his telephone conversations with Monica Lewinsky as occasional. In fact, there are at least 55 documented telephone conversations between the President of the United States and a young intern. And without going into further graphic detail, the evidence shows that at least on 17 of those occasions, those conversations included much more than mere sexual banter, as the president described it. The most unsettling part of that statement was uttered near the close. Listen to what the president said. "I regret that what began as a friendship came to include this conduct." Friendship. The very day the president met and spoke with a young White House intern for the first time was the day he invited her back to the Oval Office to perform sex acts on him. In fact, Monica Lewinsky said that after their sexual relationship was over a month old, she didn't even think the president knew her name. The president's statement about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, beginning as a friendship, is a callous and deceptive mischaracterization of how his relationship with this young woman really began. Thus, the president began his deposition testimony by reading a false and misleading statement to the grand jury. He then used that statement as an excuse not to answer specific questions that were directly relevant to allowing the grand jury to complete its criminal investigation. Had he given specific answers to specific questions about the true nature of his relationship, the grand jury would have been able to learn the whole truth about whether the president perjured himself and obstructed justice in the Paula Jones sexual harassment civil rights lawsuit. Paula Jones had a legal and constitutional right to learn if the president, while as president or governor, used his position of power and influence to get sexual favors from subordinate female employees in the workplace, or to reward subordinate female employees for granting such favors to him. Instead, the president intentionally provided on 19 separate occasions a misleading statement instead of giving a true characterization of his conduct as required by his oath. He had no legal or constitutional right to refuse to answer such questions without claiming a Fifth Amendment privilege and then allowing Judge Wright to make a determination as to whether the privilege applied. The president's preliminary statement, delivered 19 times, was an initial shot across the perjury bow offered by the president throughout his grand jury testimony. It showed a premeditated effort to thwart the grand jury's criminal investigation, to justify his prior wrongdoing, and to deny Paula Jones her constitutional right to bring forward her claim in a court of law. The President gave further perjurious, false, and misleading testimony regarding the nature and details of his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. One of the ways the President tried to justify his perjurious answers in the Jones deposition about his relationship was to deconstruct the English language. Remember, the President was shown a copy of the definition of sexual relations that Judge Wright approved in his January deposition. This definition was directed by Judge Wright to be used as the guide under which the President was to answer questions about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. After carefully reviewing that definition, the President said under oath that it did not apply to his relationship with her. It is important to remember that at the time the President testified that he never had sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky, this was not a risky perjury strategy. After all, he had successfully used Vernon Jordan to get Monica Lewinsky a good job in New York, despite her questionable qualifications. She had filed a false affidavit in the Jones case, denying a sexual relationship with the President. She and the President had previously agreed to comprehensive cover stories to deny the truth of their relationship if anyone ever confronted them about it. And the bevy of gifts the President had given to Monica were now nestled safely under Betty Curry's bed so that they would never be produced to or discovered by Mrs. Jones's attorneys in compliance with their subpoena to have those gifts produced. The perjury strategy was a safe bet in January at his deposition, but it soon turned upside down for the President. By the time of his grand jury testimony in August, the President knew things had changed drastically, but not in his favor. In light of Ms. Lewinsky's cooperation with the independent counsel, the impending FBI report on her on the DNA testing on the blue dress, and the President's decision not to confess to his crime, the President needed to come up with some excuse. Here is how the President, at his August grand jury appearance, tried to explain away his January deposition denial of engaging in sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky.
Did you understand the words in the first portion of the exhibit, Mr. President? That is, for the purposes of this deposition, a person engages in, quote unquote, sexual relations, and a person knowingly engages in or causes. Did you understand, do you understand the words there in that phrase?
Yes. I can tell you what my understanding of the definition is if you want me to do it. My understanding of this definition is that it covers contact by the person being deposed with the enumerated areas if the contact is done with an intent to arouse or gratify. That's my understanding of the definition.
What did you believe the definition to include and exclude? What kinds of activities?
I thought the definition included any activity by the person being deposed, where the person was the actor and came in contact with those parts of the bodies with the purpose of intent or gratification, and excluded any other activity. For example, kissing's not covered by that, I don't think.
Did you understand the definition to be limited to sexual activity?
Yes, I understood the definition to be limited to physical contact with those areas of the body with the specific intent to arouse or gratify. That's what I understood it to be.
What specific acts did the definition include as you understood the definition on January 17, 1998?
Any contact with the areas there mentioned, sir. If you contacted those parts of the body with an intent to arouse or gratify, that is covered.
What did you understand?
The person being deposed. If the person being deposed contacted those parts of another person's body with an intent to arouse or gratify, that was covered.
If that answer sounded confusing to you, there's a reason for that. It was meant to be. What the president now was saying to the grand jury is that during their intimate relationship in the Oval Office, Monica Lewinsky had sexual relations with him. He didn't have sexual relations with her. Consider that for a moment. The president is asking everyone to believe that between the years 1995 and 1997, while Monica Lewinsky was engaged in a pattern of explicit availability for him, as she described in her testimony, the president carefully avoided having any intimate contact with her, as described in Judge Wright's very detailed definition. And according to the president, since he never intimately touched her as described in the definition, she only touched him, then he was under no obligation to answer questions in the harassment suit about Monica Lewinsky, as federal judge Susan Weber Wright ordered him to do under oath. Not only does the president's claim strain all boundaries of common sense, it is directly in conflict with Monica Lewinsky's detailed and corroborated accounts of their relationship. And if this ridiculous expansion of Judge Wright's definition of what constituted sexual relations wasn't enough, the president then decided to take his interpretation of the judge's definition one step further. He added a new element as to why he claimed the definition didn't apply to him. When asked again at his grand jury testimony what he thought the definition of sexual relations meant, here is the new twist that the president came up with.
As I remember from the previous discussion, they said this was some kind of definition that had something to do with sexual harassment. So that implies it's forcing to me. And there was never any issue of forcing in the case involving any of these questions they were asking. They made it clear in this discussion I just reviewed that what they were referring to was intentional sexual conduct, not some sort of forcible abusive behavior. So I basically I don't think I paid any attention to it, because it appeared to me that that was something that was, had no reference to the facts on, that they admitted they were asking me about.
The president now took the position that the definition didn't apply to him because it would only have applied if he forced himself on Monica Lewinsky. Remember the definition, and I will read it again. For the purposes of this deposition, a person engages in sexual relations when the person knowingly engages in or causes contact with the enumerated body parts of any person with an intent to arouse or gratify the sexual desires of any person. As you can see, this straightforward definition did not include the subject of force or harassment. Yet when the independent counsel's attorney tried to clarify the president's newfound position, the president gave no ground. He simply plowed ahead with his new interpretation.
I'm just trying to understand, Mr. President, you indicated that you put the definition in the context of a sexual harassment case.
No, I think it was not in the context of sexual harassment. I just reread those four pages, which obviously the grand jury doesn't have. But there was some reference to the fact that this definition apparently had some connection to some definition in another context, and that this was being used not in that context, not necessarily in the context of sexual harassment. So I would think that this causes would means to force someone to do something. That's what I read it. That's the only point I'm trying to make. Therefore, I did not believe that anyone had ever suggested that I had forced anyone to do anything, and that I did not do that, and so that could not have had any bearing on any questions related to Ms. Lewinsky.
The evidence clearly shows from Monica Lewinsky's sworn testimony that the president deconstructed the English language to deny Paula Jones the opportunity to find out if other witnesses were out there who would help her bolster her case against the president. And she was legally entitled to do that under our sexual harassment laws. No reasonable interpretation of the President's testimony could be made that he fulfilled his legal obligation to testify to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. His statements were perjurious. They were designed to defeat Paula Jones's right to pursue her sexual harassment civil rights lawsuit against this president. And by the way, in his testimony, the president conceded that if Monica Lewinsky's recitation of the facts was true, he would have perjured himself both in his deposition testimony and in repeating his denials before the grand jury. Listen to this.
You testified that you didn't have sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky in the Jones deposition under that definition,
correct? That's correct, sir.
If the person being deposed touched the genitalia of another person, would that be in with the intent to arouse the sexual desire, arouse or gratify, as defined in definition one? Would that be, under your understanding, then and now, sexual relations?
Yes, sir.
Yes, it would?
Yes, it would. If you had a direct contact with any of these places in the body, if you had direct contact with intent to arouse or gratify, that would fall within the definition.
So you didn't do any of those three things with Monica Lewinsky?
You are free to infer that my testimony is that I did not have sexual relations as I understood this term to be defined.
So who is telling the truth? The only way to really know is to bring forth the witnesses, put them under oath, and give each juror, each member of this body, the opportunity to make that determination of credibility. Because the record shows that Monica Lewinsky delivered consistent and detailed testimony under oath regarding many specific encounters with the president that clearly fell within the definition of sexual relations from the Jones deposition. Monica Lewinsky's memory and accounts of these incidents are amazingly corroborated by her recollection of dates, places, and phone calls, which correspond with the official White House entrance logs and phone records. Monica Lewinsky's testimony is further corroborated through DNA testing and the testimony of her friends and family members to whom she made near contemporaneous statements about the relationship. Most importantly, Monica Lewinsky had every reason to tell the truth to the grand jury. She was under a threat of prosecution for perjury, not only for her grand jury testimony, but also for the false affidavit she filed on behalf of the president in the Jones case. She knew then, and she knows today, that her immunity agreement could be revoked at any time if she lies under oath, or if she lied under oath in the past. Truthful testimony was and remains a condition for her immunity from prosecution. By way of contrast, the president was under obligation to give complete answers. Instead, he offered false answers that violated the oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And incidentally, during his grand jury testimony, the president actually suggested that he had a right to give less than complete answers. Why? Because he questioned the motives of Mrs. Jones in bringing her lawsuit. If this standard is acceptable, what does that do to the search for truth when an oath is administered in a courtroom to one who claims to question the motives of their opponent in a trial? This suggestion has no basis in law, and it is destructive to the truth-seeking function of the courts. The president's perjurious legal hair-splitting used to bypass the requirement of telling the complete truth denied Paula Jones her constitutional right to have her day in court and an orderly disposition of her claim in the sexual harassment case against the president. To dismiss this conduct with a shrug because it is just about sex is to say that the sexual harassment laws protecting women in the workplace do not apply to powerful employers or others in high places of privilege. As one WAG recently noted, if this case is just about sex, then robbery is just a disagreement over money. Next, the president perjured himself before the grand jury when he repeated previous perjured answers he gave in the deposition in the Paula Jones case. In his grand jury testimony in August, the president admitted he had to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth when he testified in the Paula Jones deposition.